Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsum a day for the 23rd of Sivan. The 23rd of Sivan, I actually found a tshuva, a responsum, that I originally wasn't thinking of how I could share it with you, and then it turned out to have a lot of interesting things in it, because on the 23rd of Sivan, sometime in the 70s, 23rd of Sivan, Tavshin Lamed Aleph was 1971, Rav Moshe chose to write up some of the forms he had used for various Jewish occasions. So I'm not going to read out all the forms, but some of the forms have interesting ideas in them that I did think would be worth sharing. So for example, the first of those is a nusach, a form, or the wording of Tefillah HaDerech that Rav Moshe used to say. There is a custom from the time of the Gemara, a bracha, that when one leaves on a journey, there's all discussion about how long the journey has to be, but if one leaves town on a journey, basically, one is supposed to say Tefillah HaDerech, say a short prayer asking for Hashem's protection along the road. So much of it is the same as the Tefillah HaDerech we all know, which you can look up in a Siddur. I just wanted to point out a couple of differences that were in Rav Moshe's version. First of all, we have Tolichenu Shalom, V'Tatzidenu Shalom, you take us and make our steps for the peace. And then Rav Moshe puts in V'Tadrichenu L'Shalom, you make sure that our path has peace to it. And I found a version of Tfilat HaDerech online on the internet didn't have that. Then it said V'Tismichenu Shalom V'Tagi'enu, that's Rav Moshe's, whereas on the internet it had V'Tanchenu El, you lead us to. Those are relatively minor. But then Rav Moshe included V'tachzireinu l'shalom, and Rav Moshe also has, this is the key one, Rav Moshe has, when we say, and you protect us from all of the problems that could come up on the road, v'chayot road, and mitrek shod avot baderech, Rav Moshe has baderech, whereas on the internet it said, la'olam, and I think my memory had always been that we say la'olam to the world, whereas Rav Moshe, it's version, which actually makes a lot of sense once you think about it, was that the evils that are going to come on this path, because after all, what we're praying for is not protection in general. What we're praying for is that this road that we're going on, this journey that we're taking, should work out well. So those are a couple of interesting things about Rav Moshe's version of Tefillat HaDerech as opposed to ours. The next form that he has, though, is he gives you a form of a mechiras chametz that he had done, a form of selling chametz that he had done before Pesach. And he had given the right to his student, Rav Nissen Alpert, who was a story of his own. Rav Nissen Alpert was a YU Rosh Yeshiva who had a very close relationship with Moshe Feinstein. And he gives you the form of what he had given when he wanted to empower Rabbi Alpert to sell his chametz for him. So he says, I give him the power to sell it. And then he says, in every place that has chametz, he makes clear that it doesn't have to be full chametz, even if it's a chashash chametz, a worry about chametz, or a mixture of chametz. Then he says, alcohol. And he says, in where he's talking about, what he's telling, he says, there are 11 containers of schnapps or vodka, liquors like that. Some of them are full, and some of them are half full or empty, and he thinks all told it's about 10 containers of it. He says that, so that's an interesting thing, that Rav Moshe seems to think it's not good enough just to say, I'm selling you whatever's there. You have to itemize it to some extent, so he itemized the amount of alcohol that was there. He says that Alpert has the right to sell it to any non-Jew he wants to, even if it's a non-Jew who's not trustworthy. Now, the reason to say this is, I think, because if after Pesach it turns out that the non-Jew was non-trustworthy in terms of the sale, you might think that that nullifies the sale. Meaning, if you think about it, our mechirat chametz always involves going to a non-Jew, selling him the chametz, the non-Jew gives a symbolic amount of money for the sale, and then after Pesach, whatever goes wrong in the sale, and we buy it back from the non-Jew. But you want to be sure that it doesn't come. I know I had a story once with somebody saying to me, you know, the non-Jew that we sold the chametz to proved not to have the ready cash to pay us back. And my deep instinct was to say, well, maybe we next year we should use a different non-Jew. But you don't want to say things like that because that would seem to imply that maybe the sale shouldn't be good. I sold the chametz wanting to get rid of it, and now he can't go through on the sale. Maybe that nullifies the sale to begin with. So when Rav Moshe says you can sell it even to a Yehudi, a non-Jew who's not ne'eman, who's not trustworthy, I think he's covering that eventuality, that even if something goes wrong after with the sale, such that we're going to have to buy it back and deal with problems, you shouldn't think that gets rid of the sale to begin with. Then he does other things of it are more common. He lends him all of the containers. He lends the non-Jew all of the containers for the 10 days before between then and when Pesach was going to between then and when they were going to think to buy it back and to rent the parts of the house where the chametz is, and then Rav Moshe specified it. It's the part of the kitchen, which he refers to as cheder habishul, as the cooking room, in the north part, in the closet, in the upper closet, and then in the closet in the hall. And I will note that Rav Moshe uses the word hall, hey, aleph, lamed, rather than prosdor, or whatever the modern Hebrew word would be for hall, near the doorway, which is in the south, and the three shelves on the bottom. And then he talks about the porch, meaning he goes to exactly where the chametz is, whereas very often in our form study, he just sort of fill out a general thing, but he's much more specific about it, and he says, it's in my house at 455 FDR Drive, a building that I looked up and still exists, and I thought it was interesting that in 1971, he's already a 76-year-old man, but in 1971, Rav Moshe Feinstein was willing to let the public know where he lived and not have to worry about whatever one could worry about with these kinds of things. And then he has the right as the stand-in for his yeshiva for MTJ, Masifta Tiferet Yerushalayim, which was on East Broadway, and he does all that. And he again goes through where the chametz is, in the kitchen and in the basement, and all the chametz is there, and there are 16 containers of schnapps or vodka there. And then there's also, he says, four small containers of flavor and a pint of vinegar. So going through it very carefully, so to make clear what the sale is, which is not exactly always what I've seen done in our times. There are also four containers of soup and five pints of flour and all the sorts of things that there are. Then he goes to his son's possessions as well, meaning his son, Rav David Feinstein, was selling his things through Rav Moshe as well. So there's the closet in that house, which was at 477 FDR Drive. And then for his other son, and the Masifta of Staten Island already existed, where the other son, Rav Shalom Reuven, was the Gaba, was able to be the stand-in to sell their chametz for them, and his grandson, Mordechai Tendler, and that's all the sale of chametz that he did through Rav Alpert. So a couple of things in that sale of chametz. To me, the willingness to let his address just be easily known, as well as the specificity both of the amounts of chametz and the types of chametz he's selling, as well as the exact places being named in terms of which closet and which hall and which drawers. That's a second form that you have. Then he has a form of a smicha that he gave, right? So smicha originally was where one member of the chain of Jewish tradition would verify that a student had learned enough and studied enough to take his place in the chain of the Misorah. That's a smicha going back to Moshe at Sinai. That's a smicha that we lost early on in the time of the Gemara. So nowadays, when we get a smicha, it's more in the sense of saying that somebody is a person who's appropriate and worthy of being a rabbi for the Jewish people, who's worthy of deciding certain kinds of questions of halacha. So in this case, Rav Moshe verifies, he writes about the person, he leaves out the name, but somebody who was in the Kollel in Spring Valley, New York, and he says, Haya etzli eze pi'amim. He was with me a few times, meaning that Rav Moshe doesn't know this fellow, but the fellow wants a smicha from him, so apparently Rav Moshe made him come a couple of times. And he writes, V'tiyalnu aruchot uksarot b'herbe inyanim b'divrei Torah. And we spoke sometimes briefly, sometimes at length, about issues of divrei Torah in various parts of the Torah. And I saw that he has a good knowledge, and he understands things, and many of the Masechtot of Shas with the poskim, and he knows how to discuss it and to figure out and to think about the things that are written in the Gemara and how to infer properly and appropriately from one thing to the other, how to apply it from one case to another. And he's also a Yirei Shamayim Be'emet. He's also certainly a God-fearing man, and he's He comes from a good yichus, and he acts properly, and he has good character, and he cares about the study of Torah, and therefore I say that it's appropriate to call him a rabbi, and that he has the right for me to teach Torah and to rule on issues that come his way, yad yad yorah, all those kinds of things. And therefore he can accept a rabbinic position in any community that wants him according to this, and he signs it, and that's the smicha that Rav Moshe gave. Interesting thing about that smicha is he doesn't verify, or he doesn't specify for us in this case how many times they sat together, how much, what topics they spoke about, how he knows it. So he's giving him yad and yad and yorah yorah. That would sound like the fellow also knows choshen mish, but he knows matters of civil law in addition to the usual curriculum, but that's not specified here in the tshuva. And it, to me, is an open and interesting question as to exactly how much Rav Moshe would have required the fellow to know and to convince him of before he would give it. Later on in these forms, he signs on as a Beit Din on a Pruz bull that we'll get to. One of the other signers was a man named Rav Meza, who, I don't know if it's the same one, but reminded me, and it's relevant to our discussion here, that I think the word is that Jackie Mason, the comedian, who later clearly left Observance, originally got smicha at MTJ. So that's always an interesting question. It's not only Rav Moshe, it's not only MTJ. There are plenty of places that are given out smichot, and that the person later turns out to be somebody who that institution does not find to have followed in any of the paths they would have recommended. So that's a question about a smicha always. As you give smicha to somebody, you're saying something about them. The question of how well we know that person and how confident we feel that we can be sure that person will go in the paths we want to. So the answer is we can never be fully confident. The Gemara talks about Yochanan Kohen Gadol, that there was a Kohen Gadol once who after 80 years, meaning I think we think that it means he was 80 years old, but some people think it was that he was 80 years serving as Kohen Gadol, he turned into a tzduki, into a Sadducee. So watching Rav Moshe give smicha to a fellow from the Kol of the Spring Valley who's just a fellow and who he just knows from a couple of times of encountering him, it's an interesting thing to watch. I assume that Rav Moshe had heard from people in the Kol of the Spring Valley that he really was a very good fellow and he'd gotten recommendations beforehand, but it's always something to think about. And also something to think about that whenever you give a degree to somebody, they're going to use that degree forever, and that will not necessarily reflect on the degree-granting institution, meaning people change even if at the time that they were given the degree, they were fully appropriate for that degree. That's another issue that can come up. So that's the smicha that Rav Moshe gave and the form for which he included in this tshuva, in this responsum, that was written on our day on the 23rd of Sivan. I should mention perhaps that this is Igor Moshe Choshen Mishpat, section of Choshen Mishpat, the third section, the third piece of Choshen Mishpat that Rav Moshe had written on, Siman Lamed, the 30th Siman. After the smicha, Rav Moshe goes on to a nusach of a prusbul. Right, a prizbul was created by not Hillel that we think of Hillel in the time of the Mishnah, but Hillel in the time of the Gemara. The worry being that people were stopping to lend money to people because of the practice of Shemitat Ksafim, that every 7 years, at the end of the Shemitah year, at the end of the agricultural Shemitah year, we are also supposed to forgive all of our loans. That's called Shemitat Ksafim. In our times, that is a rabbinic requirement, not a Torah requirement. And so as part of that rabbinic requirement, Hillel found the right to create something called a prizbul, which is, as Rav Moshe's form will tell us, which is where the person gives their loans over to the court, and the court is not obligated in Shemitat Ksafim, and then the person retains the right or gets the right to serve as the court's messenger to collect the loan. So it's a way around, but it's a way around a rabbinic requirement rather than a Torah requirement. So the form of the prizbul that he has is that we on this court signed below, no, I'm sorry, that we signed below, give over to the court, and the court will have three members to it, all of the loans that people owe us, whether the people owe to us, reminder that there are two kinds of loans in halacha. There's a loan bishtar that was written down in a deed, in a bill, in an actual written form of the loan, or ba'al peh, or just a loan without any written attachment to it. This prizbul will give us the right to collect them whenever we want to. Because we'll be like the court, we'll be like the representative of the court to do that, and if the court doesn't do it for us when we want them to, we'll have the right to do so, and then you sign it, and that's what a prizbul is. And then he also has a form of prizbul that he served as a judge on, and those forms start with the words b'motav tilta, with three of us sitting together, b'beitin kechad ha'avinan, we became like a court, and so-and-so came before us and said he was giving us the loans, etc., and that's what happened. And And that's the place where it was a Rabbi Meza, who I have no idea if it's Jackie Mason's father, but the idea being, but still being true, that I've heard that Jackie Mason had smicha from MTJ. So that's Prizbul, a form of Prizbul. Then the next form is a nusach of a tnaim that are written near, close to the time of a chuppah, meaning originally, when people got married to people from far, far away, and transportation was a problem, transportation was an issue, so there's two kinds of questions that come up. There's the actual technical wedding. Man and woman want to get married, they want to get married, but unfortunately, in a lot of cases, there's also sort of obligations on either side. So today, those are handled relatively informally, meaning, I just heard recently of a couple that was talking about the fact their, you know, child was planning on getting married, and the parents are supposed to get together and talk about how the young couple is going to be supported while they're in school or while they're setting themselves up or stuff like this. So it can be, it's not true of every wedding, but it can be in weddings. There's lots of stuff to discuss. There's also the wedding itself to discuss, right? Especially in our weddings today where people spend huge amounts of money. So who's going to spend what on what? So it could be, let's say, one side would have been happy to make a modest, reasonable wedding that would have cost X thousands of dollars. And another one would have wanted to make a wedding that would have cost, you know, much, much more. So then the discussion of who will pay for what and how it will work, those are all issues that come up. In times gone by, I once heard of a guy told me that his mechutin, his prospective mechutin, says to him, listen, we don't have to fight about these things. Just give me $100,000 and I'll take care of the whole wedding. And the man had never planned on spending $100,000 for a whole wedding, let alone for his half of the wedding. So these things can come up. So in times gone by, the ways that families arranged it was they would sit down and they would write out tnaim. They would write out the conditions, write out the obligations. And the reason to do that, although it obviously can also lead to problems and fights and bad blood and hurt feelings, the reason to do it, just like in any contract, just like in any business venture, is because if you can lay things out ahead of time, you hope to avoid misunderstandings along the way. And that was the point of Tanayim as well, although it often did happen, in fact, that you got to the wedding and one side or the other side felt that things had not gone right. And then weddings, unfortunately and sadly sometimes in the olden days, broke up over such things. There are halakhic questions about what to do if a wedding seems to be about to go forward, and then it seems to be broken up, and then it goes forward again because of all sorts of halakhic issues that come up. In any case, in our days, tonight we're completely a pure formality because people don't really write these conditions ahead of time. They don't really make a clear written version of what people owe. So our tonight, as Rav Moshe points out, there's Yalav Yismach, right? People said this should all be successful. We hope that Hashem will be happy with this marriage, right? In terms of this brit and these tanaim and these conditions. And then we say, what we declare is that the father standing on the side of the chatan, or the man standing on the side of the chatan, usually the father, and so-and-so standing on the side of the kala, note that, and this might be a leftover from time when brides and grooms were much younger, but they're not treated in this context as their own agents. They have people standing in for them, and then we declare all of the conditions on either side towards the other side have been met, and therefore nobody has any claims against anybody else, and therefore we hope the wedding will happen, b'shah tov mutzlachah, at a good time, kedat Moshe Yisrael, etc., and they shouldn't cheat each other, and they shouldn't try to get away with each other, because in fact, worth remembering that it can get very complicated trying to put two families together, trying to put two financial views of the world together, and it's not always so simple at all, and something to keep in mind. So that tonight, when you hear the tonight read at the next wedding you go to, think about the fact that what we're saying is we're having the wedding come off, we're all being friendly here, and we can always hope that that's actually true, that they are in fact actually friendly and not just saying it for the purpose of the tonight, for the purpose of the wedding being able to go forward. The next form in the tshuva is a form of a chalitza. So the form of a chalitza is, let's remember, a chalitza is what happens if, sadly, a man passes away without children. So his wife is supposed to, as far as Torah law concerned, was supposed to marry one of the man's brothers. And then by virtue of that, it was supposed to be in some way a memorial to the original husband who had passed away. We today no longer do that. We do, instead, the option the Torah seems to have preferred less, seems to have looked down upon, became already in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara, became the preferred version, which would be where the wife would not in fact marry a brother. Instead, the couple would perform a chalitza, Chalitza was where the brother would be wearing a shoe, the wife would take the shoe off, she would spit in the shoe. It's a whole ceremony. But along with the ceremony, you would write out the chalitza that had happened, that they saw the chalitza and that it happened. So she has proof that, yes, she was married to so-and-so. Yes, he passed away with that children, and they have a chalitza. Chalitzas don't happen all that often today. It's a lasting regret of mine that I once had a chance to view a chalitza when it was happening, and I just chose not to go. And it's not so common. I've never seen a chalitza done. In addition to which, Rav Moshe here has a form for something that I had not remembered at all, but is in fact completely the halacha. If you look in Eben Ezer, Kuf Samach Tet 169, and it's based on the Gemara in Yevamot 101b, I will say many, many years ago, I was applying to a certain kollel, and I didn't get in, but I had an interview with somebody whose name I won't mention, but whoever it was, when they were interviewing me for this kollel, asked me a question on Yevamot. And I said, I hadn't learned Yevamot yet. And he asked me another question on Yevamot. And I said, I hadn't learned Yevamot yet. And again, the interview went basically like that. It was all questions for Yevamot. And so I went through Yevamot once, but not that I would then go back for the interview. But here's a Gemara in Yevamot that I clearly hadn't remembered on Kuf Aleph Amud Bet 101b, they have an Ezer in Kuf Samach Tet 169, paragraph 4, points out that Tuchima Dayinim L'Chadchila L'Kuboa Makom, that before one does a chalitza, one should declare the place for that chalitza, and declare this is the place we're going to have the chalitza, and we're going to go to such and such place to do the chalitza. Rav Moshe clearly understood, and therefore it seems to be the halacha, that not only do you declare it, but you should do it in writing. And so therefore he has a form which says, and here's this one I'm going to read a little bit, it says, Nelech l'cheder hasfarim, we're going to go to the book room, which I think it means the library or the Beit Midrash, and we're going to establish ourselves there to do the chalitza on Sunday for such woman from such man, and that's what we're doing. It's going to be there in this place, it's Rosh Chodesh Iyar in 1958, and that's what we're doing. And and here's where Rav Dov Meza is one of the signing judges on this. So that's the chalitza. The piece being that I hadn't remembered or hadn't realized that you have to have a kviyat chalitza, you have to have a kviyat makom, and that Rav Moshe held the kviyat makom, the establishing the place for the chalitza, wasn't only verbal, but it should be in writing. The rest of the tshuva and the other forms that are here are various forms of halachic wills. Right? Halachic wills are today a problem because, as far as the original halacha was concerned, the way it is in the Gemara, so men, male sons inherited, and daughters didn't. And in general, inheritance was very fixed and very established in a way that people don't always want. So there were various workarounds that developed over time in terms of halacha, in terms of wills. So Rav Moshe has a couple of examples of that here at the end of the tshuva. So one is, he writes out a whole form where the man, the father, the mother. There's a woman who is apparently a widow or not married for sure, and she wants to set up a will, and so you have her writing a form, and then you have the judges below that. Rav Moshe has an ashrata da dayinana al hanal, that they verify that they were sitting there as three judges, and we heard this woman who came before them and said these things, and they verify that she had said this. So you have the court verifying the form that was written above. Now the form that was written above, She writes that she got to old age, and it's interesting phrasing, right? She came to the days of old age, and nobody knows when they're going to die, something worth remembering, so she's making plans, meaning since she can't know. And she wants to give whatever of her possessions are left after she passes away. And the way to say after she passes away is, after I have a length of days. You don't want to, in anything we say, we don't want to give the impression that we're hoping for less than a length of days. And all of my possessions, whether it's landed property, whether it's movable property, whether it's cash, whether it's money that I have in a bank, right? I want to leave it for my children. And then she names her children. And so she has three sons and a daughter. And she wants to give a quarter of whatever's left to the daughter, which means basically she wants, and it seems like none of the sons is a bechor, because what she says is, I want to give a fourth to my daughter, which only makes sense if we're hoping they split equally. It only makes sense if the three sons are supposed to get everything equally as well. That would imply that none of the sons qualified as a bechor, as a firstborn. Oh, I'm sorry. She doesn't have the obligation. Women don't have the obligation to have a bechor. I apologize. I take that back. So she has four children. She wants to give them equally. So she says what she's hoping they'll do is, what she's telling them to do is, that the sons will get it all, because that's what the Torah says. And she's telling them she wants them to give a quarter of it as a gift, a quarter of the whole estate as a gift to their sister. And she is hoping and assuming that they will happily fulfill their wishes, because there is a principle that if somebody tells you to do something and then they pass away, you're supposed to fulfill their wishes. So that's one halakhic way around it, meaning she's not circumventing Torah law. She's not saying Torah law doesn't apply, which is another way to do these things sometimes when it comes to monetary issues. She's saying, I'm going to do it by Torah law, but I am telling my sons that they should then give a quarter of the entire property to their sister. And then she's written this in a will as well, and she says, in the will that I wrote, in the civil will that I wrote with lawyers, right, that's just so that it'll have the force that the courts, in the secular courts, will also uphold these rulings. And then she says, even though I trust that my sons will do what I'm telling them to do, I've done this. And then she verifies, because asiti kshani b'deat tzlulah miyushevet, I want people to understand I'm doing this with we in English would say of sound mind and body. And that's what I'm doing, and I've given a commandment to write this out, and therefore it's all of it. So that's one way around these issues, is to give it as a gift. No, to command the children who are inheriting it to then give part of it as a gift, and to let them know that the will that was written is evidence of her desires, and also will make it valid in secular court. But that's not the actual formal process going on. That from a halakhic perspective, what's going on is there's the inheritance the Torah law set up, and then the sons fulfilling their mother's wishes by giving the gift as they were supposed to. Another version was to give a gift to somebody, and then to say, and if that person passes away, then it should go to so-and-so. So again, a person says, verifies their sound mind and body, and they're still able to walk around, and they're still healthy. So commands that after he passes away, everything that he has should go to his wife. So that's a gift that he's giving her. But then after she passes away, after she has a long and healthy life, then he says, I want three parts of it to go as a gift to my daughters. So each one of them will get a third, and the fourth part will go to my son as a Yerusha, who's the only son. And if he says, if my wife wants to get married after I pass away, so that's fine, because he's no longer around, but then it should immediately go to the daughters and the son. And just that they have to give their mother the value of the ketubah, because that's what a woman gets after her husband passes away. She can get the value of her ketubah, as a rav will tell them to do. It's another way to get around these inheritance laws here. You want the wife to get it, but he also wants Yerusha to kick in, so he's allowed to say, I'm giving it as a gift, and that gift only lasts until she passes away or gets remarried, at which point I'm giving it as a gift to the three daughters, plus a fourth of it will go to the son as Yerusha. Another way. Final way, and this is the one, the form that has on it the date of the 23rd of Sivan, which wasn't, after all, what led us to be able to use it on this day. Here it's a matnas bariv, isur nechasim labanot. So this person who's signing below says that, since, again, he goes into the form of, since people don't know when they're going to pass away, and I decided to set up my affairs and to try to take care of things that will happen after the arichus yamai, after my length of days, even though right now I am healthy and walking around in the marketplace of sound and mind and body and all those kinds of things. So he's got one son who's married with a family. He's got two daughters, one married and one not yet married. And he wants the daughters to also have some stuff. And therefore he says you should give a quarter to the daughter who's married and a quarter to the daughter who's not yet married. And also, now he says, "Uvazen nichnas gam ha'isur nechassin le'nedunya." And it should also include the tenth, and that includes the tenth that would ordinarily be given. There's a common custom that when a daughter gets married, that you give her a tenth of your assets, of your wealth, and that is her dowry. Now, often that is swallowed up by the costs of the wedding. I remember many, many years ago when I was single and not even close to getting married, a friend from high school who got married young mentioned that her family had given her X amount of money, and they said, her parents, and they said, this is what you're getting from us. You can either use it for the wedding, or you can use it to support your lifestyle. You can use it for whatever you want, but this is what you're getting. So that's sort of what this father is doing. It's not clear to me in the form if he's saying that the second daughter only gets the same quarter as her older sister, and tough luck on her because she didn't manage to get married before her father passed away, or if he meant that you should put another tenth into her quarter. I think it's the former. I think he's saying they'll each get a quarter, and the daughter who stayed unmarried until after I passed away, well, her tenth is included in that quarter. However, that you read that part of the form, the rest should go to my son as a Yerusha's inheritance, like the Torah law says, and that's the will that you have. So notice that this father says he wants to take care of his daughters, but he does still, in fact, prefer the son over the daughters and gives the son more than he gives to the daughters, which makes for, I think, interesting family dynamics in our times, especially when people aren't used to that. So these are some of the forms that Rav Moshe Feinstein shared with us whenever he published this volume of Igros Moshe, one of the forms having been written on the 23rd of Sivan for 1971, and therefore becoming our responsive day for this day, the 23rd of Sivan. Have a great day.